This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: anti-royalist activists turning to social media to call for the abolishment of the British monarchy. Tehran says Washington's latest sanctions show the U.S. is behind the false scenario accusing Iran of conducting cyber attacks in Albania. And the U.S. says that it has no hostile intents towards North Korea in reaction to Pyongyang's new law. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. 2 days have passed since the death of the longest-reigning British monarch. Britons now think it is the right time to ask for Elizabeth II to be remembered as their last head of state. Hashtag abolish the monarchy is trending on various social media platforms. People think it does not make sense for another monarch to be elected in the 21st century. They also think the royal family is a political institution which lives off people's taxes and does not make any contributions to the society. Meanwhile, calls are growing in the former UK colonies in the Caribbean to remove the British monarch as their head of state. Some Commonwealth leaders have expressed doubt about what the role of the monarch is in today's time. Activists also argue that Charles's accession is an opportunity to redouble calls for slavery repatriations.
Britain has a new monarch. King Charles III used his first address to the nation since taking the throne to pay tribute to his late mother.
Queen Elizabeth was a life well lived, a promise with destiny kept, and she is mourned most deeply in her passing. That promise of lifelong service I renew to you all today.
Earlier, the new king, alongside Queen Consort Camilla, met well wishers gathered outside Buckingham Palace, paying their respects after the passing of Queen Elizabeth II on Thursday. Gun salutes, floral tributes, and flags flying at half-mast symbolise the country in the first phase of an official 12-day mourning period. Messages of condolences flooded in from world leaders, with domestic tributes being led in the House of Commons by the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss.
Today, we show the world that we do not fear what lies ahead. We send our deepest sympathy to all members of the royal family. We pay tribute to our late Queen, and we offer loyal service to our new King.
These are unprecedented times, and the parliamentarians will be getting used to saying God save the king instead of God save the queen. But what will a monarchy under the stewardship of Charles III really look like? Charles's ascension to the throne comes following a 7-decade-long reign by the late monarch.
Lots of people who maybe were not great fans of the monarchy as an institution respected Queen Elizabeth II for her longevity, for her record. They forgot many of the things that she was also associated with, the end of empire, which is often very brutal in places like Kenya. But they gave her some respect, and you'll see that, I think, over the next 12 days. You'll see people prepared to give that respect to the Queen. I think it's going to be a very different story going down the road, and we should remember that the monarchy is very important to the British elite. The armed forces, the security services, judiciary, they swear loyalty not to Parliament, but to the monarchy.
Charles's new role as king comes at not just a tumultuous time for the throne, but for the country itself.
if he's going to be an effective king, he will have to speak to the nation in a way that brings people together. And that may involve him, and as Charles has known to do this in the past, be a very much more politically, overtly political monarch than some of his predecessors. He's made interventions on various issues, and I think he'll continue to do that going forward.
At home and abroad, there'll be questions about what Britain's new monarch's vision will be. Will the tentacles of the new reign bring forth a new dawn? Former subjects across the world will simply wait and see. Amina Taylor, London.
Ukraine's president says the country's forces have retaken control of dozens of towns as they push a counteroffensive against Russian forces in the northeast.
Up to now, the armed forces of Ukraine have liberated and took control of about 30 settlements in the Kharkiv region. In a number of villages in the area, activities to check and secure the territory are ongoing. Gradually, we take over new settlements. Everywhere, we return the Ukrainian flag and safety to our people.
Zelensky's comments follow reports that fierce battles are underway in Kharkiv region. Moscow has not confirmed any advances by the Ukrainian forces, but it says that it is sending in more reinforcements to the area. Intense fighting is also raging in the south, where a Ukrainian counteroffensive is making progress in the Russian-held Kherson region. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials say 8 people have been killed and over a dozen injured in attacks on a town in the eastern Donbass region. Russia has denied targeting civilians. A new report on poverty in France has revealed the devastating economic effects caused by Europe's sanctions on Russia over the Ukraine war. Multiple indicators have reached record lows, showing that their lower classes are worse off in decades.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people, because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next 2 economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2%, and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed, because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iran has roundly condemned the United States' imposition of sanctions against Iranian Ministry of Intelligence and its minister. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said Washington's new bans, like its previous illegal sanctions, will not be able to sap Iranian authorities' will to serve the nation. He said that the United States' support for Albania's baseless accusations against Iran is a clear proof that the White House itself is behind the whole scenario and that Tirana has fallen victim to Washington's move. Tehran's reaction came after Washington imposed sanctions on Iran's intelligence minister over alleged cyber attacks against Albania, which is a U.S. ally. Iran has dismissed the charges, saying that the Islamic Republic itself has been a victim of cyber attacks. Relations between Iran and Albania have been tense since the Balkan nation provided a safe haven for the anti-Iran terrorist group MKO. Political analyst Said Mustafa Khoshchishma says that the MKO terrorist group based in Albania conducts cyber attacks against Iran every now and then.
You know, the Albanian government is corrupt enough to be ruled by the United States. There is no denial of that. They've been hosting a terrorist group, thousands of them in Camp Ashraf in Albania and outside, who've been running software attacks, fake news media, as well as cyber attacks on Iranian facilities for quite a long time. And pictures and videos coming out from the hall shows that hundreds of them and maybe 1,000 of them are sitting behind the laptop and running campaign against the Islamic Republic, which is not just fake news, but also cyber attacks. But the terrorist group, MKO, Mujahideen Khalq Organization, the hypocrites, MEK, PMOI, PMI, NCR, NCRI, no matter what they are called, they change names like the Al-Qaeda in Syria to clean up their records. It doesn't matter because they've killed 17,000 Iranian civilians and officials in the past several decades, including a prime minister, a president, a judiciary chief, a prosecutor general, as well as 72 MPs and 17,000 other civilians, and they have so much blood on their hands.
Palestinians have set an Israeli military tower ablaze in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Palestinian media say 7 Israeli soldiers were also injured in the incident. The military structure, located at the entrance of Beit Omar town, was set on fire by a Molotov cocktail. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has hailed it as a heroic act. A senior Hamas member says that setting the Israeli structure ablaze shows the fragility of the regime's fortifications. Palestinians have rallied in the Gaza Strip to slam Israeli violations against Al-Aqsa Mosque and the occupied Al-Quds. The Friday rally comes amid rising Israeli violations against the Holy Shrine. Ashraf Shannon reports.
A rally has been held in the besieged Gaza Strip to show support for Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds against the growing Israeli aggressions. Protesters have chanted slogans against the Israeli regime and called for an end to the Israeli occupation. Tensions have soared in Al-Quds in recent weeks as extremist Israeli settlers backed by Israeli forces desecrated Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against committing violations in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque will not be tolerated by the Palestinian people. Our people will defend Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque with all means. Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line that must not be crossed.
People have come out to reiterate their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against the Israeli attacks. Al-Quds is a holy region of significant importance for all Muslims around the world.
Palestinian resistance groups will defend Al-Quds and will always be a safety valve to protect our people. Armed resistance is the key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
This protest is sending a strong message to the whole world that Gaza will not sit idly while Al-Quds is being desecrated. Al-Quds is the eternal capital of Palestine. We also want to condemn the daily killing of our people in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces and the construction of illegal settlements as well as home demolitions.
Since the Israeli occupation of Al-Quds in 1967, the city and Al-Aqsa Mosque have been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice. Palestinians in the blockaded coastal territory say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
North Korea is facing criticism from several countries as well as the United Nations for declaring itself a nuclear weapons state. The UN chief has expressed deep concern over the North's new enshrining the right to use a preemptive nuclear strikes. Antonio Guterres has urged Pyongyang to resume talks to achieve sustainable peace. France also has condemned the law as a threat to international and regional peace and security. Paris says North Korea's aggressive declaration effectively eliminates the possibility of denuclearization talks. However, the U.S. has reacted cautiously, saying it has no hostile intent towards the North and continues to seek diplomacy. North Korea has officially enshrined the right to use nuclear weapons to protect itself. The North Korean leader has described the law as irreversible. The country is already under international sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. Local analyst Kim Do-shu says North Korea feels threatened by the U.S. military presence in South Korea, and that is the reason why Pyongyang says it reserves the right to defend itself in case of a potential attack.
So when the United States talk about a threat from North Korea, people in the West often ignore the fact that North Korea feels threatened by the United States, by the presence of the U.S. military forces in the soil of South Korea, remember. And also sometimes the U.S. will fly in, for example, B-52. That's a lethal force, obviously. I would say a real threat to the sovereignty and the security of North Korea. So both sides feel the threat from each other. They need to sit down and talk about their security issue and then move forward of building a normal country-to-country relationship. But so far, what we have seen is, you know, in Seoul, there's a new government which has given up the previous practice of engaging North Korea or sanction policy in the sense that is more engagement with North Korea, and so they can build a peaceful and stable relationship or stability in the Korean Peninsula.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
departure.
A quarter century after the fall of the Iron Curtain, never have there been so many politically driven walls in our world. Dividing communities, separating the rich from the poor, and marking borders, walls have become the preferred solution for resolving major conflicts. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. This week's documentary explores how the business of constructing barriers is pursued with ever greater physical, financial, and ideological vigor in the 21st century. From the Middle East to the wealthiest societies of the West, municipal, regional, and international walls have become the preferred means of resolving conflicts and addressing or avoiding civil unrest. Stay with us as we investigate the geopolitics of urban and cultural segregation as seen in Iraq, Brazil, and France.
Just imagine that tomorrow we were to live in private villages behind high security fences. The Mirail neighborhood in Toulouse. 35,000 people live here. From the outside, it's considered a volatile ghetto. The Mirail is dogged by high unemployment and boredom. At night, as a distraction, youngsters noisily rev their engines. This is a public area. Only one association is trying to maintain some sort of law and order, a local group called the Mediators.
Don't hang about here, right under the buildings. Go home. Look at the time. People are asleep now.
Okay, we'll go. Actually, until the Mediators tell us to go home, we hang around outside. Do the residents ever call the police to say they can't stand the bloody noise anymore? Yeah, it can happen. It happens often. They call the police, yeah, sure. We know that because they see that the police won't intervene, so they ask us to help. We get involved, but as you saw, they're on public property. And we can talk to them. Tell them to put their motorbikes away. If they listen, all the better. The police never come here for that sort of thing. Well, if they do, it would be a game of cat and mouse, you know what I mean? In this kind of social housing, they now take care of their own security. They've learned to live without the police. That doesn't bother you? No, it's okay. I've never been scared. She's been here since 1975. No, and sometimes I go out. I come back at 4 or 5 in the morning. Used to come home and I never had any problems. That means there's a... What about the police? Do they ever come here when you call them? The police? I don't know. I really don't know. But I think it would be worse if they did come. Zubir Sadi was born here, grew up here, and has witnessed the neighborhood slowly change. They've only just got their license as well. I've looked after him for a while now. All he did were stupid things. I saw the mix of people who used to live here. There were whites, Europeans, all sorts of backgrounds. I used to see my parents, they'd go and visit the neighbours. All sorts of different mixes of people. But slowly people began to leave. And we were lucky, because we experienced that kind of diversity. These youngsters don't know that. I was scared, to be honest. There was always so much noise. I saw cars set on fire. But unfortunately, the police would never come. Because they'd get attacked. So you felt the estate was left to fend for itself. Yeah, that's right. We'll turn over here. Paulette is one of the middle-class residents that has fled the social housing estates. There, that's it. That last building down there. I used to live there, up on the 6th floor. Do you ever come back?
No.
No. I never wanted to come back. And I never have. Why not? I don't feel comfortable. You see, where I live now, there are just 2 floors. Here, there can be as many as 15 floors. It's like cages for hens. Paulette moved to a nearby protected estate. there are more of them in Toulouse than anywhere else in France. She now feels much better. We all know each other. We're safe. We can leave the door open. No one can come in. There are no problems. We're not scared of anything. Here we go, this way. Enclosed residences are not necessarily ghettos for the rich. Paulette is a civil servant. That's nice, isn't it? She has a modest salary and a 45 square meter apartment like all those who live here. With her neighbours, Paulette has rediscovered some of the warmth of the poorer areas. I've got just about everybody's spare set of keys, because some of my neighbours are a bit scatty, so you never know. It's very friendly here in this residence. I think it's very pleasant to be here. We're not far from town, and it's a bit like being in the countryside. It's quiet, you can walk around, and there's a pool. It's like a holiday camp. But here, the rules are strict. Even too strict, says Christine, a resident. They've been sending out non-stop things, you know, like notices telling people how to behave, not to make too much noise. I think it's, well, yeah, the rules are a bit strict sometimes. I mean, to ask children not to shout outside. When they need to shout, kids shout. If I hear a kid laughing, I don't think it's a nuisance. That's all. You know, I'm fairly moderate. I don't know. I think it's a bit much. Well, it's not the kids for me, it's the adults. The ones who don't show respect for others, to be honest. There was one person here who wasn't very nice. He made a lot of mistakes. Well, he made noise once or twice. No, he was noisy. I mean, I couldn't sleep once. But my neighbor's camera picked him up. In this small paradise, if you make too much noise, the various security devices will hear you. We're undergoing an urban segregation in this country. Some have recently suggested using the term fragmentation to describe this new kind of town made up of separate parts that have increasingly less in common with each other. So it really marks the end of a kind of society. Yes, it could well be the end of a certain type of society, or in fact a new multi-speed society, a club society, in which the public good is considered like a club. If you can afford it, you pay for membership of the club and benefit from the goods. If you can't, you won't have them. Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where the economy is booming. The country, though, is cut into two. The middle classes have flocked into enclosed areas, condominiums, entire sectors behind high railings and armed guards. Brazil is copying Florida with its gated communities, enclosed villages. Right next to the condominiums are the world's largest slums. Two nations, that of the rich and the poor, who live on either side of the ramparts. Thais and her mother always lived in the so-called condominios. Well, the idea for condominios came from keeping people closed off, but with hobbies and things to do on the inside. There's a bar where you can meet your friends. It's also to be close to each other without needing to go out or risk being attacked. Why? Because the streets are considered dangerous? Yes, yeah, especially at night. And you can't be at the mercy of other people in the streets. Unfortunately, that's today's reality. So they found the way to mix safety with hobbies and pastimes. It's like being outside. In fact, a whole generation is growing up inside the condominiums that will never get to know the real Brazil. It's true. I really think we've created gilded cages like this one. We're prisoners of luxury. I really wish my children were as lucky as I was. I grew up in an apartment block, but we used to play out in the streets. I had that freedom. Today, if I go past the same area where I grew up, I see it's no longer possible. Everyone's a bit more enclosed nowadays. Right alongside the condominiums are the favelas. It's the Brazil of the workers and cleaning women, as well as armed teenagers who live off the drugs trade. They form an alternative kind of justice in these forgotten slums. Shaolin has been in charge of the Residents' Association for a long time. To him, segregation is the worst form of violence. More than the physical wall that separates us, there's the invisible social wall, which is far more hurtful. The superior classes in their buildings, and we, people of no class, in our huts. Right next to each other. The city has to integrate, otherwise there'll be chaos. Directly opposite the huge favela Rocinha on the São Conrado beach are some of the most expensive housing estates in Brazil. They're not just criminals up there. There are some better people up there than they are down here. More honest people. One day, Augusta witnessed a shootout between cocaine traffickers and military police. A scene from a war film. There was a problem fairly recently between the guys from the Vidigal favela and those from Rocinha. They encountered the military police and there was a fight. They ran off, and in the confusion, they crossed in, went out the other side. That's it. They caused no trouble. They just crossed through. You know, this wall, it's not real security. There are 500,000, 400,000 of them, and just 10,000 of us. If they come down, nothing will stop them. On the other side of the railings, the government decided to seize control of the favelas. November 2010, the army and its armored cars are called in. 4 days of fighting in the north zone eventually forces the traffickers out. Troops hoist the national colors, a symbol of the victory of one nation over another. Today, Captain Felipe Barreto and his men are on patrol to prevent the gangs from returning. I don't know any city like Rio, with the rich right next to the poor, literally wall to wall. The social impact is very negative. You see down there, where the car is? Before, the police wouldn't have been able to go there. 20 meters away, they'd shoot at you. Just one cop on the corner and they'd open fire. So that was the border? Yeah, that was the border. And what about the other public services? Can they come in? Firemen, postmen, doctors? Well, before, it was only with the permission of the traffickers. So it was a parallel government. Exactly, the media used to call it parallel powers. Are there less now? Oh, yeah, many were killed. And they fled as well, right? Yeah, all were arrested. Others moved to Rocinha. Rocinha is home to countless thousands of poor. Among them, some heavily armed young men. The traffickers tolerated our presence on their territory so long as we never filmed them. And we were given escorts. One longtime member of the drug world does, however, agree to be interviewed. Nowadays, Regis has stopped dealing. He's settled down, has a family and work, and tries to lead a dignified life. Like most dealers, Regis was also an addict. I took a lot of drugs for 10 years. From the ages of 15 to 26, I hit rock bottom. A lot of cocaine, alcohol. Oh, it lasted for 10 years. I lost my friends, traffickers, thieves. I used to live among all of that. They call me the last of the Mohicans. Why? Because the rest of my generation are all dead. For many of the favela's youngsters, drugs remains the easiest career move. With the intoxicating feeling the street belongs to you. They are arrogant and well-armed, but few will live to see 30. They will be killed by the police or rival gangs. People used to look at me differently. They'd look away when they saw me. My own mother didn't trust me anymore. But thanks to God, I was able to get out of it. Now I have my daughter, my wife, my house and my work. It must be a struggle. Yeah, it is a struggle. But the most important thing is to have abandoned the drug scene. The favelas issue is about successive governments having basically abandoned them. It's just government negligence. That's why we're in the state we're in today. After having assaulted the area, the police tries to do some social work. A community police unit has set up in the middle of the favela, its aim to stop the drug gangs returning. We arrive, we set up, and then we determine what the needs are, and we try and get back into the areas that have been abandoned. By the state? Yeah, by the state and by society in general. Captain Barreto's men have established an advance base at the top of the favela. It's a strategic position with a bird's eye view over the condominiums. And Baghdad, the city of 1,000 walls. After 8 years of war, a fragile peace exists behind these concrete ramparts. The walls crisscross the city over hundreds of kilometers, causing never-ending detours. Abu Hazem is a taxi driver in the Daura district, which was controlled by insurgents back in 2007. I have to go around the wall, go to the end of the motorway, and come all the way back. It's like a huge prison. It's bad for morale, too. Does the wall make it safer? Does it bring work? In fact, the wall has made it safer. Before, no one could pass here. It was too dangerous. Between 2003 and 2007, Iraq was ravaged by an incredibly vicious civil war. US soldiers were constantly targeted. Certain areas were completely controlled by the insurgents. The Shiite and Sunni militias began killing each other. According to The Lancet, a respected medical journal, 600,000 civilians were killed. That's when the Americans conceived of the idea of building walls around the most violent areas. They would contain the insurrection and separate the Sunnis from the Shiites. Baghdad would resemble Berlin during the time of the wall. The US Army spokesman, however, confirms they are also building gated housing, like the retired people's homes in California.
We're building different walls all throughout the city here, different communities, and you've heard the concept of gated communities.
Mm-hmm. Funny, a gated community, to me, just connotes, you know, an exclusive sort of Coral Gables, Florida kind of setup. Which is not what you mean, is it?
The gated communities are designed to protect the population in selected neighborhoods throughout Baghdad.
Many of them don't like it at all. They feel that it will further divide the city on sectarian lines.
Well, the intent is not to divide the city on sectarian lines. Once again, the intent is to provide a more secure neighborhood for the people that live in selected neighborhoods. And if we find areas that we think that the gated communities will do good and will control the population, we'll probably build more.
Each zone is surrounded by a wall. It's like living on a reserve. We're stuck inside. The wall was the Americans' idea. It was American material and vehicles that were used to build it. There never was the split between Sunnis and Shiites before the Americans arrived. Sunnis, Shiites, Christians and Jews, we were all Iraqis first. And the first thing the Americans ask you now is, are you Shiite or Sunni?
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners, sisters and brothers. This is Arab English Radio. Once more, I have the honor to be here with you. You're listening to Asma. And in here, we talk basically some literary stuffs related to Ashura and the Battle of Karbala. In today's episode, I've picked a piece that I will read it for you, and then we will discuss the issues related to it. The night of the 10th. That night, the sky was red like blood. It was the hardest night for the family of the Prophet. In the emptiness of the desert, they faced the darkness and loneliness of night. During the night, they could hear a voice coining from the darkness. The disguised person recited the following lines of poetry. Oh, those who killed Imam Hussein, be prepared for the punishment. You are cursed by every prophet and every religion. This was not their word for the messenger of God. If he was alive now, he would have cried. Also in this night, Umm Salama had a dream in which she saw the prophet. He was upset and the dust was on his head. When Umm Salama asked him why he was so dusty, the Prophet replied, "My son was killed and I was digging a grave for him." Then the army of Umar marched towards the women and children and looted whatever was in tents. When they were done, they set the remaining tents on fire. The soldiers fought over the women, but they resisted and ran in all different directions. The soldier took their robes, rings, and earrings. As they took the earring of one of the daughters of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, she asked him, "Why are you crying?" Because he was crying while doing that. He answered, "Because I'm stealing this from a daughter of the family of the Prophet." She asked, "Then why are you taking it?" He said, "Because if I did not take it, somebody else will." At the very beginning, let me just tell you who was Umm Salama. Umm Salama was one of the wives of the Prophet. And here we just told the dream she had about the Prophet. After reading this piece, what comes to the mind of the reader is the very fact that what happens to the soul of a human being who would turn into such a beast? You know, in hierarchical formats in literature, we usually talk about this hierarchy, that there is God, the Almighty, and then there are the angels, and then human beings stand in the middle of the angels and the beasts and then the devils. So what happens to a person to drag himself or herself down to the position of the beasts and devil and demons instead of taking himself or herself into an upper position to reach out the position of angels and the honorable people? You see, it is very easy to change the string that you have between goodness and evil. As we can see it in our everyday life, you know, the string between a truth and a lie is very delicate. In a blink of an eye, you would turn from tyrant into a martyr. So it is very easy for you to change it all around, whether it be from good to bad or from bad to good. But the thing is that when you are going to change it from bad into goodness, it is going to be more of a drudgery. It's going to be more difficult. That is why we insist on keeping the purity of our hearts. That is what we should learn from the story of Karbala, that it is not always the decisions that you made for long terms that would help you. Because sometimes in a larger scale, when you are making a decision, that might seem true. But the truth is that in some special situations, when you are in need of a decision to make on the spot, You know, what happened in the Battle of Karbala was the situation in which they had to flip a coin. In just some days, the people who were real human beings turned into beasts, and they had a hand in the killing and bloodshed of the grandson of the prophet. So it is not always like this, that what happens to these people is a very far-fetched sort of a thing. No, in a blink of an eye, in a heartbeat, just as you close your eyes, suddenly you are going to turn into somebody who's going to actually make the wrong decision and take the wrongest step in their life. So what I just wanted you to focus on was that, well, as human beings, we have a soul, and this soul needs to be preached. All the time, you have to take a careful consideration of the very fact that God is watching over you. Whatever you do, every single action you take is going to be judged at the day of judgment. So you must be very careful for every single action you take, every single step you make. Just it, you know? That's the end of the story.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
You as a human being are responsible for every action you make in your life. We read it in this piece that the guy says, if I did not do it, another person would come to do it. Okay, what happens to you that you accept it upon yourself to do such a horrible deed against the daughter of the prophet? You know, you must have changed into a beast without even knowing it. This is really, really horrible. And it could happen to every single person. Now, even in our modern life, we could see that there are so many people who are practicing tyrannism toward other people, toward the oppressed people, toward the weak ones, without considering the fact that there'd be a day in which they'd be judged, they're going to be judged. And it really is something that is very much close to us. It's nothing so far away and like the story that will never happen to us, it will only happen to others. No, the stories of Karbala, I guess the quote that we hear it very much in these days is that every day is Ashura and every land is Karbala, is very precisely put, because even in our modern life, even in our daily basis sort of life, we are ought to make decisions. And the whole aim of life is to see how you are going to make it through. How you are going to make your decisions. Is it going to be bad? Is it going to be good? Are you going to side with the goodness? Are you going to side with the devils, with the evils? And, you know, it's very easy to lie to yourself sometimes. Sometimes you cover and hide the truth and you say, okay, I'm doing it for blah, 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 blah. You just justify yourself. But the truth is that you are skipping from reality, from the truth, from the fact that you are turning into a monster without even noticing. That's very important to take care of, you know? Your soul is like a diamond. You have to keep it the way it is. And if you do not take a special care of it, then out of that diamond, there would remain nothing for you except some ashes. So this is going to be so dramatic if you do not consider it. In this piece, we learn that human beings are not always the same as they are today. Sometimes they change, and in a blink of an eye, they would turn into monsters. And we should be very, very careful to take care of our soul and heart. Thank you for listening.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every clove. Hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.